Welcome to How I Lawyer, a podcast where I talk to attorneys from throughout the profession about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. I'm your host, Jonah Perlin, a law professor in Washington, D.C. This episode is sponsored, edited, and engineered by my friends at LawPods. LawPods is a professional podcast production company focused solely on attorney podcasting. I absolutely love working with them, and if you're considering becoming a legal podcaster or just want to learn more, check them out at lawpods.com. And now, let's get started. Hello, and welcome back. In today's episode, I'm excited to speak with Ryan McKeon, who's the co-founder and CEO at the Connecticut Trial Firm, where he is a catastrophic injury lawyer and now spends most of his time leading the firm. In addition to his expertise and experience in the courtroom, Ryan is a sought-after speaker on topics related to law firm leadership and success for personal injury lawyers. He's also the author of two books, Tiger Tactics, Powerful Strategies for Winning Law Firms, and CEO Edition. He's seen as a leader in the plaintiff's bar and is active on LinkedIn, which is where he and I met. And he shares his lessons from running his own firm and his life as a lawyer to more than 16,000 followers. He started his career at a firm in East Hartford, Connecticut, before opening his own firm and eventually starting the firm he leads now. He's a graduate of Framingham State University, go Rams, and Western New England University School of Law, go Bears. Welcome to the podcast, and thanks for being here, Ryan.
Jonah, thank you so much for having me. So excited to be here.
Yeah, it's funny. We were talking before we got started that I feel like our paths have crossed many times, but we've never actually gotten to meet digitally. And there's something special about meeting somebody who you feel like you already know, even digitally and even in whatever version of the pandemic we're in now, there's such power into just like getting on a call and seeing somebody face-to-face, even through the Zoom lens. So I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Like, it's a remarkable time to be alive and to be able to connect with people all over the country or world for that matter, who have the similar interests. Like, there's a lot of power in ideas and connection, and I draw a lot of energy from it.
Totally. I love that. So let's start from the beginning. Sometimes I frame this question as your origin story, if you were a superhero, but more down to earth. Tell me about your decision to go to law school and become a lawyer in the first place. And sort of, was this always the plan?
It wasn't the plan. I'm the first person in my family to even graduate from a four-year college. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. My dad was an Army veteran who went into telecommunications. So I grew up in really middle-class town, and basically the best thing that you could do in the town was be a teacher. That's an amazing thing. So I went to Framingham State College, which is actually the first teacher school in the country, first normal school in the country, go Rams. And I wanted to learn how to be a teacher. And just over time, like, it just, I enjoyed helping people. I enjoyed working on student government. And it felt like teaching history just in high school was not for me or not for the life that I wanted to lead. My hands aren't skilled enough to become a surgeon or anything like that. And business didn't really interest me a ton. So I was like, well, law seems like a great opportunity to use my liberal arts skills, reading, writing, and actually help people. So I went to law school.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I love the teacher shout out, because I think so much of what we do as lawyers, no matter what kind of law we practice, frankly, is being strategic thinkers, but also teaching people and different audiences what we do and why we do it and how we can make our clients succeed or how we can make the government succeed if you're a government lawyer. And so I think that teaching law connection is actually a lot stronger than I think a lot of people let on. And I've had a lot of great former teachers or people related to former teachers on the show. But going into law school with that interest, you still sound like you had a lot of things you could do with your JD. So talk me a little bit through how you sort of found yourself after law school as you started your career. What did you do? How did you get there? And how did you sort of think about that?
What I knew was, I knew two things. I really enjoyed litigation. I enjoyed like mock trial and all of those things. So I had a real, real interest in it. I didn't have any interest in becoming a public defender in criminal law, really. And I wanted to help people. Like, I didn't want to represent big companies. I didn't want to work for the government. I wanted to help people with their problems. So that's what I did, and I was able to earn a job at a general practice firm, one of these small local town law firms that are dying. I mean, you really don't see like the place where you get your will done and your divorce and your business started and your DUI handled, that kind of thing. But that's what this firm was. And the lawyers were sort of aging out of wanting to do litigation. So I was able to get a lot of litigation and trial experience very early on in my practice because they let me do things.
Yeah. And talk to me a little bit about sort of a lot of the people who are listening to this podcast are probably either just beginning their career or fairly early. Talk to me a little bit about sort of the strategies or just experiences you had trying to learn from more senior lawyers who might not have been intentionally there to sort of teach a more junior lawyer. But clearly, I mean, even on your LinkedIn profile, you call that point in your life the time where I learned how to practice law. But that's like a very challenging place to be in for a junior lawyer. Talk to me a little bit about how you'd recommend either senior partners help their junior lawyers or junior lawyers sort of take ownership early in their career.
Yeah, I mean, I think two things. I'm going to start with the junior lawyer perspective. The junior lawyer perspective, I remember my salary, and this was 2005, was $43,500. That was my yearly salary. Like, there was maybe the possibility of a bonus, but it's a small law firm. Like, it's a law firm that's built on really representing blue-collar people, plumbers, electricians, grandma who needs to will, that kind of thing. But I remember one of the lawyers who I'd worked for in law school told me, he's like, look, it's not the salary, but he's like, think about it. You were paying $40,000 a year to go to law school. Now you're being paid $43,000 a year to learn. You're like $80,000, right? Because you're being paid to learn. And it was that mindset of like, okay, like watch what the good lawyers do. Watch how they generate business. Go with them anytime you can. Go to court. Observe other good lawyers. There's nothing that beats sort of osmosis isn't the right word, but experiential learning, observing, and being open to it, being open to thinking and asking questions and challenging yourself to make every day a day in which you learn and grow in your career. I think as sort of a, if you become the senior partner and you've got younger lawyers, I think it's important that you recognize that there's almost an obligation because I don't know any lawyer who doesn't achieve, who achieves any modicum of success who doesn't have mentorship in this profession. I think it's really at the core of the legal profession. What has to happen there, I think, is there has to be training and structures and systems and supports that really set the person up for success. But there also has to be space at some point. There has to be space for them to learn, to struggle, to overcome, to maybe even fail. Ideally, it's not a failure in terms of what happens for the client or anything. You have obligations to prevent that, but give them some space to process. I think I was very fortunate because, look, I was taking cases where I was representing indigent people who were in psychiatric institutions against their will, being paid $50 an hour by the state of Connecticut. So like I was fortunate to have that gift. And obviously, if the stakes are much higher, you're not just given the opportunity to go in and try a case and practice.
I had a partner I worked for early on who said to me, don't work for people who, when they hear you haven't done something, say you can't do it. Work for people who, when they hear you haven't done something, say, well, then you absolutely have to do it. Because that's what it comes down to, is learning by doing. And I'm going to be the last person on the planet to knock legal education. I think it's incredibly important. And I think we do a lot of great things, but there's a lot of on-the-job learning, which it sounds like you got.
Yeah, I think it was referred to at the time as baptism by fire. So it was stressful, unnerving, but ultimately it taught me to be self-sufficient, to identify issues, to develop strategies, and to learn, you know, take advantage. Nobody's going to take ownership of your career. I think it is a mistake that I see younger lawyers make. You have to take ownership of your career. So if you want to be an expert in something, like go to that CLE, find the time, buy the book, read the stuff. You're ultimately responsible for your success as a lawyer or whatever your career is, really.
And then ultimately, not too long after that, within the sort of first decade of practice, although I imagine it felt like a very long time, but I'd be curious on your thoughts on that. You decided to sort of go out on your own and take ownership not only of your career, but of your legal practice. Talk to me a little bit about that decision and what that felt like and sort of how you reflect back on that time now.
It was a terrifying decision. I mean, even though I wasn't making much money, I had a daughter and we had student loans and My wife worked for the government, and yeah, we relied upon my paycheck. Like, there was no two ways about it. There was maybe $10,000 in savings, and I started my firm with $2,500. There's nothing as motivating that I can think of as sort of being in my shoes maybe in at this point in 2012. But what I realized when I was working at the firm was 2012, that time frame was a real watershed moment for legal technology. That's really when cloud-based technology came into, it's when it started hitting its stride. Like, internet speeds were fast enough. Things like Clio had made a mark, Dropbox had made a mark, Google Workspace, all of these sorts of different cloud-based things, RingCentral. These are, you know, I don't use Clio, but these are all sorts of softwares that I use even to this day. And so what may have taken me, gosh, I wouldn't have the money to have built it, I can now get a user license for $15 a month or $20 a month. And what I saw was there was an incredible opportunity to, for me, it was be paperless. I was completely paperless in 2012. I've never had paper in my practice in all the years since. They were a paper firm. And it was sort of like, well, look, if I was going to stay in this lane, I knew I was going to be sort of swimming against the tide. If I'm young, I'm at this point, I'm like 32 years old. And I'm like, but there's a whole world of opportunity and practice is changing. And in order for me to ride that wave, I've got to hop on a different boat.
I don't know that I expected the answer to that to be so legal tech focused. And that's something that obviously is a big topic. I mean, it's a topic that I write about as well in sort of my academic life. 2012 was a real watershed. I mean, that's also the first year you have the American Bar Association sort of adding new legal rules related to technology as well. I mean, the profession is fundamentally changing. I guess I'd love to hear a little bit more about what you mean when you say you could do things that you couldn't do, either not paperless or pre-technology. It's obviously the barrier to entry is lower to running a firm, but sort of brass tacks, what has technology allowed you to do or did it allow you to do then that you don't think you could have done even 5 or 10 years earlier?
This one's easy. I mean, so you had to be in the office to work or you had to take files home. So there's like a huge inefficiency to that. And being able to pull up your whole practice on your phone was just an incredible efficiency. And when you aren't having a bunch of paper, it reduces the size of like the space that you need to do work. In fact, I mean, I demoed the Apple Vision Pro a few weeks ago and it's like, well, you could have like 20 monitors that are ginormous when you're sitting on an airplane seat, like completely, completely wild. So it divorced work from really time and place, right? And so that to me is sort of like the early edge to all of this, this real ability to just really not be tied to a physical location. Like that's a big, big deal.
And I think if anybody's listening to this in history or in the future, and they look back and they mark sort of COVID as the moment when everything changed, I think that's a mistake. I think the change was already happening and we had to change in new ways, obviously, when the COVID pandemic hit. But I think that's such an amazing point.
When COVID hit our firm, nothing changed, except we weren't in the office. Like nothing at all changed. People had their laptops, all Zoom, all RingCentral, everything was all in place. So business as usual, except for the courts being closed.
Talk to me a little bit also about sort of what kind of cases you were taking on. I mean, I know you said you were in a very general interest kind of firm. And then when you went out on your own, you kind of got to choose how you specialized. Talk to me a little bit about what that looked like on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. So what was happening was I was getting all sorts of cases. And the ones that I really liked the most that I felt I could do the most good on were the personal injury cases. And so I just gravitated to wanting to get better at those. And really, by just doing a good job by people, by my existing clients on other matters, I started generating some significant wrongful death litigation, some wrongful death claims. And so I was at that moment and I was like, what do I do? Like, who am I? Do I refer these cases out and take a referral fee? Or do I use them to sort of build my skills and build my career? Because I'm like, I can handle these. Like, I have the baseline skills and I can learn the sort of more advanced things. And so I decided to keep those cases. And then I decided to train with some of the best trial lawyers I could find nationally to really work those cases to be able to get really great results for my clients. So that is how sort of my practice becomes focused on personal injury. There's a lag in there because with personal injury practice is unlike almost any other business model that I can think of, in that every case you sign up is debt. So we sign up a case, we work a case, we work a case, we put money into a case. And then on average, we get paid about 18 months later after we started doing our work, right? So you could get the best case in the world and go broke trying to get there. So I needed to take things like family cases and other things that were hourly that kept the lights on as I progressed more and more into just doing personal injury. And then I closed the door on my other sort of general litigation practice.
So interesting. Two follow-ups to that. The first, I want to know a little bit about the training piece, because I think one thing that you talked about was sort of the traditional mentorship or even apprenticeship model of being in a firm, being trained by people in your firm. But it sounds like you did a lot of learning and education and training after you went out on your own. Talk to me a little bit about what that looked like and sort of the choreography of getting training even when you go out on your own.
So what happened was I looked at sort of like, well, who were the best trial lawyers in Connecticut? And I said, okay, who are these people? Then I'm like, what do they do? Where do they go? Because there seems to be, like, I didn't accept the idea that, like, people are born trial lawyers. Like, I never accepted that. Like, there are, like, some people are born to play guitar and like, maybe play sports. But I felt like trial law, because I saw all sorts of different kinds of people. Some people were very slick. Some people were very attractive. Some people were unattractive. Some people who stumbled around getting great results for their clients. And I'm like, well, what are they doing? So I really began to look for the playbook that they were running. And then I figured out what playbook that they were running. And I started going to conferences that the lawyers who created the playbook put on, and really sort of what I would call drinking from the source of how to do this thing that I needed to get better at doing.
And we'll talk a little bit later, I think, about sort of now you're the one doing some of that teaching, and I want to hear more about that. But my other follow-up is, it's a little bit of a surprise. I haven't really had very many personal injury lawyers on the podcast. And I guess I'm curious, I asked this question to lots of different lawyers who do lots of different things. What does somebody look in the mirror and say, like, this is what I like to do. This is what I'm good at. This is how I see my day to day. Like, what are the either skills or mindsets that you think naturally lend themselves to somebody choosing this as the sort of part of their legal profession or path within the legal profession?
I think one, it starts with a real desire to help people. Like, I think it's like, look, I get calls where people have been, you know, they've lost their daughter, they've lost their son, they've been sexually abused, they have some horrible form of cancer. I mean, like, so you get calls from people who really need help, and they have both other problems and they have legal problems. And I think when you're a personal injury lawyer, when you're doing this kind of work, like, there's, I think people who do it well are, one, they're people. Two, like, they are sort of like anti-establishment people. Like, these are the punk rock kids who are like, fight the man, fight the power, because that's what you're doing. You're taking on big companies, you're taking on insurance companies, you're always sort of playing against power, against government entities, right? And so there's that element. I think that there's sort of people who I would say are adrenaline junkies. Like, it's a huge amount of adrenaline when you work on a case for 5 years and you put $375,000 of your money into it, and then you hand it off to a jury to see what comes back. Most of my tax lawyer friends, like, they don't want that day. But for people who are sort of what I described, people-oriented, sort of a little bit of countercultural, and a little bit, they like the excitement, the creativity, the rush of it. That's sort of, I think, where most personal injury lawyers are born. But they often sometimes have origin stories where, look, somebody in their family was hurt by something. Somebody, the insurance company didn't treat them right. The company didn't treat them right. A doctor didn't treat them right. And so they become motivated in that way as well.
There's also, I think, something of a, like, personal injury lawyers get a bad rap. And I think part of that is contingent fees. Part of that is the way advertising happens. Part of that is that by definition, you're seeing people at their absolute most lowest and most in need. How do you think about that tension, and what's your response to sort of the world that kind of sees personal injury lawyers in a default negative light?
Okay. So my basic take on this one is, It is a myth created by personal injury lawyers to prevent smart students at Georgetown and other places who are from going into personal injury work. You don't want to do that.
Say more about that. I love that.
Because you can make a lot of money doing this, right? If you do it at a very high level. That's fun if you're a lawyer, and it's fun to be able to help people and get results. I think it's a myth. Half kidding on that. But I actually think that generationally, like, this has changed, and we see it in our jury pools now. I think like the boomer generation, like they were like anti-trial lawyer, like trial lawyer enemy, right? And I think sort of in the past 10 years, 8 years, maybe sort of specifically, people have become overall on all sides of the political spectrum, sort of less trustful of power, less trustful of this. You can see this in polls on the Supreme Court and of corporations, of all sorts of different things. And I think boomers were more trusting of like the local priest, we'll say. And so I think there's been a shift from personal injury lawyers being the sort of bad guy to personal injury lawyers being the good guy, the people who helped. And we see this at career fairs. We see it in juries. We see it in focus groups. And yeah, some of those attitudes still exist. And for the, and as I say, like, don't be a personal injury lawyer is invented by trial lawyers. I'm going to say what's invented by insurance companies is sort of the advertising is bad. Because we can talk a lot about access to justice and tech and rules of non-lawyer ownership and all sorts of things, right? But the biggest vehicle for access to justice has been two rules, one of which is the ability to represent people on contingency. So we don't charge people $20,000 retainers or $50,000 retainers. It's like, come as you are. We're going to try to help you. So there's that. And the other thing is that the prohibitions on advertising that have fallen, because even in today's world, like, people don't even know that when they call us, they're not being charged. The amount of times we have to explain that this is on contingency to the public, lawyers know this. So like, when you talk about these things, and look, it can be exploited, it can go too far, without question, it is fundamentally the greatest sort of access to justice tools of providing people with the ability to get into courts, the ability to get lawyers that otherwise they never could. And also the sort of ability to realize the purpose of tort law, which is fundamentally some accountability and deterrence. So things don't happen. The same thing doesn't keep happening and hurting and killing people.
Yeah. And in your industry, one of the things that we hear a lot about is sort of the end of the civil trial, right? Everything gets settled. Things are too expensive to try. At least in the federal system, I know just the sheer number of cases are down in a lot of places. Talk to me a little bit about sort of what part of your business or the business that you work in more broadly is that sort of like traditional trial work, and what's the settlement piece and how do those two things interact today?
The trial is absolutely diminishing. I'm going to say the trial is one of these things in the future that becomes more rare and more valuable for people who do it, because there's just less people who know how to do it, both on the plaintiffs and defense side. And ultimately, look, if you're not willing to try any case, then you're stuck accepting the last offer that somebody puts on the table. And maybe that last offer is a reasonable compromise and you can live with the result, but maybe it's not, right? And so at the end of that process, like, if it's not, you have no choice but to go to a jury, a judge, an arbitrator to try to change that circumstance, right? And you need the ability to put on a case to do that. So, yeah, I mean, look, there were like 7 motor vehicle trials, jury trials in Hartford, which is where Hartford, Connecticut, where we are. I mean, there's several thousand cases on the docket. 7 of them result in jury trials, right? And that number will probably continue to sort of dwindle down. And I think it dwindles down for really a few reasons. We talk about technology, but like, everything is on surveillance at the moment. You are on your neighbor's camera in some which way. And so there's really like less questions over like what happened in things. And there's more sort of a question of like, well, what are the consequences of this happening? There's way more information. There's ability for AI to go in and look at medical records and find connections. There's just a lot more information. And so oftentimes trials result when one party has more or better information and or understands their information and perceives their risk differently. So I think that the level of information sort of neutralizes that playing field. And yeah, I mean, cost absolutely factors into it. the macro trend. I mean, Jonah, you're about my age, I think. The macro trend in our life is efficiency. Everything has gotten more efficient, from how you order a pizza to booking a plane ticket to what you watch on TV. And jury trials, or trials in general, are incredibly inefficient ways of resolving disputes.
Do you think the trial skills are still going to be valuable to lawyers, even in a world where there aren't as many trials?
Yes, I absolutely do. Because if you are a client and you have some very important matter, and the other side is just not realizing that and not offering you what you need for a solution, like, then you need somebody who can go, like, there are two numbers that matter: what a jury or judge will give you, or what the other side will give you. And so you're stuck really negotiating with a hand behind your back if you're not willing and able to capably and competently put that case on in front of a fact finder.
Yeah, I mean, that's such an interesting way of thinking about it and thinking about how those skills play. Because at the end of the day, maybe the purpose of the exercise is the same, but the audience and the way you have to present that is different. And I hadn't really thought about how the fact, so much of trials was just dealing with he said, or he said, she said. There's so much less of that, especially in surveillance-based, where there's data in every vehicle and all of those things.
Data in every surgery, in every hospital room, and everywhere there is loads and loads of data. And the truth is, whenever you're listening to this today, where we're recording it, it'll be the least amount of data in the world going forward. You know, we're just going to get more and more and more data and abilities. Not only, I mean, data is one thing, but the ability to synthesize and process really through the advent of AI and make connections with large data sets that would take weeks or months to sort of sort through. AI at this point can flag those things and at least give lawyers an opportunity to dig deeper.
I mean, I guess related to that, has that changed what it looks like to do personal injury work in 2024 than it did in 2012 or 2005? Like, does the day-to-day life of the lawyer change as a result of the societal and technological changes that are happening?
No question. Where we are with AI, and we employ a lot of AI throughout our practice, we think of AI as sort of a really sort of good, like, associate or good paralegal who can help you process some information and maybe point you into the right direction. Like, it's not going to get you as a lawyer all the way there for your case, but it's going to say, like, hey, this is perhaps an issue, or look at this, this is inconsistent, this doesn't seem to work with the deposition testimony. Because on a large scale, what lawyers do is sort of data and information management. Like, it can be pretty boring. And so AI is helping us do that. AI is helping us craft demand letters. And where we're going to go with AI is really like data analysis of results, of what judges are doing, about what courts may do, risk analysis, projections. All of those things are a little bit off. AI right now isn't, at least in my world, like capable of writing briefs or things like that, but it can help you understand areas of law, I think, more efficiently. I'm thinking Westlaw AI in specific, than you would if you were just sort of doing, I mean, when I grew up in law school, they still were talking about Boolean searches and things like that.
Totally. I was, I think I was one of the last classes to be in 1L before they had natural language searching in Westlaw and Lexis. So now I teach that for a living in part. And so it's a really interesting experience. One of the things that you talk a lot about and have sort of done a lot of speaking about is this very important, very large verdict that you and your firm helped facilitate in Connecticut, $100 million verdict. And I was just hoping maybe you could tell me the story of that case, as it is sort of an exemplar of the kinds of work that you and your firm are doing right now.
I mean, this is the story of Mikey Cruz and Phillips North America Lighting. They have a subdivision called Signify, but I'm just going to call them Phillips for these purposes, okay? And what happens is Phillips North America, they're manufacturing these TLED light bulbs. And these light bulbs are really profitable for them because they're eco-friendly without having to retrofit fixtures, okay? So these are the light bulbs that basically everybody wants. And so they make the light bulbs in China and they ship them over into the United States. And when they ship them over, they don't palletize the light bulbs because they wrap them in plastic. They put a thing on the bottom called a slip sheet, And in China, they use these things called reach trucks because they don't have like basically spare wood. And the reach truck like hugs these pallet or this load of lamps that are about 1,300 pounds. And then it puts it in a shipping container. That shipping container makes its way into the US and then ultimately into a warehouse in Mountaintop, Pennsylvania, which is Philips North America's warehouse. And what they have to do is they have to unitize the lamps, the light bulbs, to the pallet. Okay. So that way, instead of having me doing hand gestures, not going to work for your podcast, but you could imagine that you have a pallet on the bottom and then you have 1,300 pounds of lamps on top. They all need to move as one for shipping purposes, right? And if you just put a pallet on top, if you just put a 1,300 pounds of lamps on top of a pallet with a slip sheet underneath, it could slip off and fall and cause the tractor trailer to tip over, fall off a shelf, as it did in this case. So what they did was, we never know why. I mean, our expert says it would have cost them $5 in 5 minutes to wrap this and unitize this load. So it would all be one, but it leaves the warehouse as ununitized. It gets put into a warehouse where my guy works, Mikey Cruz, a place called Rexel. Rexel is not a defendant. They're barred by comp, but it's likely there wouldn't have been a claim anyway. But they put it up on the top shelf about 20 feet high. And a guy on an adjacent aisle uses a reach truck. Like, so you could, aisle one, my client's on. Aisle two, this defendant named John Paul Paez is on. He uses a reach truck to go up 20 feet. He lifts the pallet on an adjacent level. It snags. It catches the pallet where the unsecured light bulbs are on, causes it to lift. The light bulbs come down like a missile, 20 feet, 1,300 pounds. They snap Mikey Cruz's spine while the pallet remains up on the racks, up on the racking system. The whole case really centered around, there's a bunch of issues, but really that's the case. And Mikey gets paralyzed and goes through all the, he's paralyzed from the navel down and suffers just tremendously. And they denied any sort of responsibility. They still are fighting this up on appeal. And so it was one of these things where they offered us $1.5 million and we had no choice but to take that to trial. Like, we couldn't take that offer for Mikey. It wasn't even close.
Wow. You've done a fair amount of this work, but is there something that you learned about this case in particular, or something you learned from this case that you're sort of, that you want the world to hear? Because it sounds like there are a lot of versions of this case, unfortunately, like accidents happen and people make bad choices, but this seems like a pretty egregious one. And it sounds like the jury recognized that as well.
The lesson out there is that, by the evidence that they're still fighting this, like, it can be a real slog. I mean, this happened in 2017. I mean, we are still, our appellate lawyers are drafting our responsive briefs as we speak. They'll be filed in, I think, a few days. But, like, it takes a lot to really sort of try to hold a big company accountable in a way that I think is meaningful.
One of the big changes that you've shared with me in your career is you've moved sort of from the world of being the on the ground everyday trial lawyer, running the file, finding the facts, making the arguments, to now running a firm as a profession. Talk to me a little bit about that change, and to somebody who's listening, who doesn't even know that that's possible with your JD, like, what is that like? And maybe what are some of the benefits and some of the challenges?
Yeah, I think the great thing about a JD is it's really a capstone liberal arts education. And so it's going to give you a good basis to do almost anything that you want to do. And I would encourage anybody out there listening, or Jonah, your students, not to just use what they've learned in law school to write briefs, but to use it in their business pursuits, to use it when they're working on their community board or the local library or whatever it is that they're doing, these analytical skills, these reasoning skills, persuasive skills. And the fact is that people are going to look to you as some example or somebody who may know what they're doing. There's some hope with this person, right? And so for me, I think for many of my colleagues, like, law is probably a series of about 10-year careers where I spent the first 10 years of my career really learning how to be a lawyer and trying to get to become the best lawyer that I could. And that was very challenging and meaningful. But I think ultimately, probably about 10 years in, it became time for another challenge for me. So, well, what am I going to do? I like law. I like helping people. I saw an opportunity to do it better. And I saw really an opportunity to have a bigger impact, because if I could build a firm knowing what I knew, if I could build systems knowing what I knew, maybe as a lawyer myself, I could handle 50 or 60 cases, but now my firm handles like 700 cases. So it's really about the ability to have impact. I understood that in order for me to have sort of impact and grow as a person, because it's immensely, immensely challenging to run a law firm, to start a law firm, to start any company. But I enjoyed the challenge and really sort of took to applying all the same vigor to that I applied to being a lawyer to the business. And that's what it is that I do now.
Do you like it?
I do like it. I think it's a lot of, most days it's a lot of fun. Some days it's hard. You know, at the end of the day, like, you are trying to lead, you're trying to teach, you're trying to solve big problems. And it's a gift. Like when somebody said, or maybe I saw it on a t-shirt, which is like, the pressure is a gift. And I think that that's true for running a law firm for me.
One of the other things that you've started doing, maybe this is in your telling you a little bit about my home life, which is I have a third grader who is very much Taylor Swift obsessed. So I will say that you sound like you're in your business leadership era, to use the T-Swift reference. One of the other things I've seen you do publicly in this era for you is sort of share wisdom publicly, whether it be on LinkedIn or in speaking. Talk to me a little bit about both the process of that, like, why are you spending your time doing that? And also, what are some of the messages that you're trying to get out into the world while people are listening?
My daughter is also a huge Taylor Swift fan. And I actually think that I, in terms of my career, am transitioning into a teaching era. Like, that's where I get my joy at the moment. And, you know, part of it for me is just like, when I wake up, like, what excites me? And it's like, it excites me to help other people who are struggling with these things and trying to go through them and trying to solve. So just for me, putting that out into the world, like, it just brings me joy. Like, I guess I could golf, I could do a whole host of other things that would be fine. But I really love helping people. And even if I think about it sort of beyond my firm, right? Say I, like a teacher, like what you do, which is like, okay, fine, I can help 700 clients at a time in my firm. But look, if I can help 700 lawyers and they can help 500 clients, then there's 35,000 people who are impacted. And so I think at this point in my life, where, you know, I've checked the boxes as a lawyer, I've checked the boxes as a business owner, what excites me is really sort of putting that back into the universe. As far as like the messages that are out there, I think there's a few, one of which is like, I really encourage anybody out there to pursue like a healthier career for them. Like, what energizes them? What makes them happy? What fulfills them? If they're at a firm that's not working for them, to go find a firm to sort of break up with sort of bad relationships or relationships that may have once worked that no longer do, and to hopefully build a healthier profession, because I've seen a number of lawyers' lives wrecked. You don't have to look very far in this profession to know of the stresses and strains. But I think we have an opportunity through dialogue, through understanding, and through, in part, tech, to make the future of law better than the past.
It's funny, because what I love about these interviews is I never know exactly where they're going to go. And we started with you focusing on how you could be a better lawyer at a small firm. And we got to like, how can you help 35,000 clients? Like, it's a story of leverage. And at each point in your career, you've been able to build that leverage. And I just think that's such an exciting way to think about a legal career. And not everybody's going to make that choice, obviously, but that's a really exciting trajectory that just, I don't know, it gives me joy hearing about it. I love that. I'm going to push back on the tech point and then I'll ask my last question. So I'm going to push back on the tech point in this way, which is I get and I agree with the fundamental premise that technology allows lawyers to do things that once were impossible as a matter of scale, leverage, whatever. On the other hand, I often see and hear from lawyers who are losing that connection to the things that matter to them, their family, their social life, their personal life, as a result of technology. Technology's always there. It allows you to practice 24/7, 365. in an industry that, minus your piece of it, is billed often on the hour. And as a result, tech isn't always the savior that maybe it's made out to be. And I guess I'd be curious about how you react to that tension.
If you're out there listening, I just think that this change is so profound and so inevitable. What I ask myself, like, are you going to swim against the tide or are you going to find a new way to ride it? And I think that that's the challenge, right? And I would encourage people to think about that and think about business models that embrace that, to, you know, whether it's on their firm leadership committees, to do therapeutic work on themselves, because like change is hard. Like humans don't really like change, but to do some work there and to also just to seek to inform yourself about what's out there. And look, like lawyers are very, very good about generating work for themselves. So there'll be battles over what AI system did what and what algorithm and algorithmic experts and boy, is this a fake video or is this not? I mean, all of these things are going to go there. But here's what I think. As I said, trial becomes more rare, but also more important. I think that lawyers become more important because whoever you're dealing with at the other end of it is a human being, whether it's a big company or somebody who wants to get their dog back from their neighbor. It's a human being with some problem. And so the skills of guidance, of being able to navigate, of being able to connect, of listening, of making smart strategic decisions and using all sorts of knowledge, like that's not going away. And in fact, I think that that should be more valuable. I wouldn't be surprised to see hourly rates go up, but the amount of hours maybe go down. I think law will adapt. I think lawyers are good at self-preservation.
I think everything you said up to that, I'm with you and I agree with, but is maybe controversial. The last sentence about lawyers adapting for pure business purposes and protecting themselves is absolutely without question a fact. Talk to me a little bit about, sort of before we get to our last question, where you think your practice, not you personally, but sort of personal injury work and firms like yours, where is it going? I know you've talked about sort of technology allowing you to do more or different things, but to somebody who might be listening to this in law school and thinking, what is it going to look like when I practice 5 years from now in this space? What are the big similarities and differences going to be?
Here's what I think. One of which is I actually think technology makes us safer. Like even though we don't have a world of autonomous cars, like car safety features have gotten incredibly better. Collision avoidance. Actually, the ability to work from home during a snowstorm like reduces, right? Honestly, like, you know, big TVs in people's homes means they're not out drinking at bars. So I think the world gets appreciably safer, right? But I also think that what I see in the personal injury space, I'm in like the single incident space, which is basically like somebody gets in a car accident, somebody suffers medical malpractice, happens once. But where a lot of the money in business is moving is into mass torts, into mass harm. And I think you're going to see a continued rise in sort of everybody sees like Camp Lejeune ads and things like that, because risk, but there's lots of money and there's lots of reward there. You're going to start to see, I think, direct to consumer self-help, where people have apps that are like, hey, let us get your meds and write the demand for you and all these sorts of things. I think that that's coming down the road, but there's still a complete lack of trial lawyers. There's still going to be a need. Parties are still going to behave unreasonably. So for those who want to do this work, I think that there's almost like limitless opportunity because, yeah, people are still going to do things that they shouldn't do. Then they're going to find new ways to hurt each other, some accidentally, some by design. I think I would still tell somebody out there, like, keep an eye on what's going on, but really master the fundamentals of your craft. Like, there's going to be value in that.
Well, that might be the answer to my last question. So we'll see how it goes. But I always like to end this with a piece of advice for someone just starting out in our profession, something either that you share with new lawyers or that you wish you knew when you were starting. Master the craft, I think, is a great one, but I'll give you the opportunity for one more if you've got it.
Two things. One of which is be kind to yourself. This is a hard enough profession and there are enough sharp elbows in this world that you don't need to be one to yourself. Okay. And if you find yourself not being kind to yourself, go and seek therapy. Go talk to somebody. Go work through that. Okay. And so that's sort of point number one. And the other thing is like, look, I think you need to have a little faith, and faith in the sense that it will all work out for you. Like, you're on your path. You may not know maybe losing that motion or that upset partner or the judge who redlined your opinion if you're a clerk or whatever. Like, you're all on your path in your journey. And as long as you seek to learn, you seek to get better, you seek feedback from honest critics, and you improve, like, it's going to be okay. It's going to be more than okay. And I think, at least for me, early on in my career, that was very, very hard to see.
Amen. I think those are both awesome ways to end this conversation. I mean, Ryan, we could talk forever. We could have a whole just conversation about, like, the change in technology in 2012 and how it impacted the law and many others. But for now, I'll just say thank you for giving me of your time and also for just being so giving of your advice and wisdom out in the world. And I hope we can keep in touch and do this again. And if I'm ever up in Connecticut, I'll make sure to say hi.
Thank you, Jonah. I'm going to come down to DC and I will, we'll have to connect. I love it down there.
I love it. All right. Well, fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Ryan. And for anybody that wants to find Ryan, I know he's very available on LinkedIn, among other places. So give him a follow. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Jonah.
Again, I am Jonah Perlin, and this is the How I Lawyer podcast. Thanks to podcast sponsor Law Pods for their expert editing. If you're a lawyer considering starting your own podcast, definitely check them out at lawpods.com. And thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, I hope you'll consider sharing it with friends and colleagues or on social media. And of course, if you haven't already done so, please sign up for the email list at howilawyer.com or subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts. As always, if you have comments, suggestions, or ideas for the show, please reach out to me at howilawyer@gmail.com or @Jonah Perlin on Twitter. Thanks again for listening and have a great week.